Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
The writer Brian Burrow says, there is actually a moment you can point to in the history of the Old West, of the very first gunfight. Now, it wasn't actually the first, but he says it was the moment when this infatuation would take hold of the country. He told us it happened late in the afternoon of July 21st, 1865. This was just 3 months after the end of the Civil War. This was in the center of the scraggly village of Springfield, Missouri.
The two men who stepped into the square just before 6 p.m. was a young man who had been a Confederate scout named Davis Tutt and a man who had been a Union scout named James Butler Hickok, more commonly known later in life as Wild Bill Hickok. And they were there because they had had a disagreement over a gambling debt.
In a photograph, Tutt has cat eyes and a goatee. That day, by one account, he wore a long leather duster. By all accounts, he was carrying a pistol and also, fatefully, a gold pocket watch, a Waltham model.
When they met there in the square that day, Hickok had warned Tutt that he had to give him back his watch.
That day, by most accounts, Hickok had a Colt Navy revolver in his hands. By all accounts, he wanted his watch back.
And everybody around town understood what that meant because the crowd had formed right there in front of the courthouse.
Everyone, it appears, understood what had to happen. Some versions say the two men turned and stood sideways, cutting their eyes toward the other for a long moment or two. Others say Tutt took a step forward. However it began, they pulled their pistols simultaneously. Tutt shot from the hip. Hickok thrust forward his left forearm, carefully laid his Colt across it, and fired at the same time.
There was gun smoke in the air, and suddenly everyone in the crowd saw a red plume blossom across Davis Tutt's chest. He yelled, "Boys, I'm killed," and staggered into the street and died.
Hickok, unblemished, wheeled around to confront a group of Tutt's pals loitering to one side. "Aren't you satisfied, gentlemen?" he asked coolly. "Put up your shooting irons, or there'll be more dead men here." The men slowly backed away.
We know all this because it reached the ears of an Eastern writer, and not long after, he published the story of this first gunfight. That, more than anything, created the archetype of the Old West gunfighter. And the real origin story of America is not the Revolutionary War, it's the Old West. That's the one place where the American dream, defined as any man in this country can make a go of it, could even get rich on his own wherewithal. You know, America, you can make the argument, stands for the worship of individualism. And what we saw on the Old West is very much the American creation myth. Men and women out there in the middle of nowhere with very few resources making a go of their own. And I posit that the gunfighter is really the figure at the core of it, the ultimate individualist, you know, a man alone in a street, perhaps, against another man, both of them with the ultimate equalizer, a gun. And what I wanted to do in this book is to tell you the story of how that myth came about and, candidly, how much of that legend is true. Because the gunfighter phenomenon is not a myth. It is solidly based on facts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Brian Burrow is joining us to talk about his new book about the gunfighters of the Old West. It's a history of this time period and the grudges and the myths that shaped it. And you're going to know a lot of the names, like Wyatt Earp and Billy the Kid and Butch Cassidy. But you'll also know a lot of the scenes, the train robberies, the bar fights, the duels, and the feuds. In the book, Burroughs says the Old West was a kaleidoscope of violence and that pretty much all of these conflicts involved guns. And he says one thing that jumps out at you about the men that participated in these fights, wherever it was that an incredible number of them were a single type of person, a Texan.
You know, the idea that the Texan is this rootin' tootin' six-shooter is so much a part of the Texas ethos, it's a cliche. And so, frankly, I was stunned how much truth there turns out to be about it. You can read editorials in New York newspapers decrying Texas gun violence and gunfighters in 1878.
Yeah.
So this is not some modern notion. So part of what I was trying to do here, I was trying to understand why the gunfighter phenomena happened and why it happened when it did between 1865 and 1901. I mean, these men who stand at the core of this legend, from Hickok to Wider to Billy the Kid to John Wesley Hardin of Texans, they didn't rise anywhere. They rose in a specific time and place. And I was trying to figure out why that was. And a lot of it turned out to have to do with Texas and the culture of Texas in those days. Mm. It should come as no surprise that, you know, Texans from birth, a birth in war against Mexico, were a heavily martial culture. Mm. They were the only state, certainly the only southern state, that had not one but two violent borders for most of the century. The Mexican border, but also, we forget, the Comanche frontier, which cut Texas in half on a diagonal into the 1870s. So Texans were always expert with firearms because pretty much they had to. You know, it's no accident that it was Texans who were the first to discover, popularize, and perfect the revolver in the 1840s, which, of course, you know, created the possibility of the gunfighter era because almost all of it happened with revolvers. But the key part was the extraordinary violence that overtook Texas in the decade after the Civil War. And I argue here in this book that you have to understand that violence to understand how it spread across the frontier in a kind of what I call the Texas diaspora. Mm.
One of the things you write early on is, to that point, is how strange it is that people became fascinated with the violence in the West. Because as you point out, like, there was a lot of violence in the East, and the people in, as you say, you know, Boston and Baltimore who were committing murders or were, you know, using weapons to kill people were just dismissed as thugs and murderers, and no one really remembers them. So what's the difference? Is it's just that the West held a kind of fascination? What was it?
Yeah, it's not only a fascination, but it's a fascination rooted in individualism. You can read a story about a criminal in the streets of Baltimore in 1847, and, you know, it doesn't mean anything. But if you're reading about a gunfighter wandering across Kansas or Texas or New Mexico or Arizona, there is that sense of possibility, that sense of the all-important skills of the individual, that that man can be anything he wants to, and that those gunfights are part of his becoming. Mm. They're part of his assertion. They're part of his growth. They're part of a career that's dictated only by him. And I think the nature of those stories is one reason why Westerns in general, from dime pulp stuff in the 19th century to movies like Tombstone in 1993, that's the principal appeal for me to the Western and to the gunfighter mythos.
The West really was violent. It wasn't a myth. It really was violent. Talk a little bit about that. One of the things you get from your book is, and I hope this isn't an aside, but you write, for example, about the hygiene of the West. It was dirty and it was smelly and it was really raw. And I wonder if just talk a little bit about how you write about the reality of it and why was it so violent?
Well, number one, you're right. It was very violent. For about 40 or 50 years, it was very de rigueur for academics to say, oh, this was just an invention of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. The West really wasn't that violent.
Yeah.
It wasn't until the 21st century and kind of the dawn of big data techniques that new researchers have crunched the numbers on murders and shootings across the West and found, it's spectacularly violent. If I'm doing this numbers off the top of my head, I may not get them right, but if 9 killings per 1,000 people is considered very violent, if you look at the Kansas cow towns where so much of this happened, you know, you're looking at rates that at not 9, but 150. It was spectacularly violent. The question becomes why? And academics have been debating frontier violence almost since the frontier closed. And for the longest time, people basically just said, well, anytime you have an underdeveloped frontier, there's not going to be a lot of law enforcement. Okay, makes sense. And anytime you have a frontier, it will tend to be populated by young men who may not have much to do, given that there's little infrastructure, at which point alcohol and gambling and other things that may lead to violence become prevalent. All of which, of course, is correct. But I argue in the book that even, you know, just saying that there's no police around and a lot of young men with booze doesn't in itself explain gun violence in the old West. You know, there has to be a reason why people shoot each other, even a stupid one. And what I found by trying to research the causes of this, I ended up doing a lot of work on the kind of the male honor system of the 19th century that became most prevalent in the antebellum South. You know, because if you look at the predecessors of Old West gunfighters, there's really only one group you can point to of American men who killed each other with any regularity with handguns before that, and that was duelists, those involved in duels, primarily in the antebellum South. So I spent a lot of time looking at that, and I came to believe that the formal structure of the duel kind of fell by the wayside as these behaviors moved to the West. What didn't were the reasons underpinning duels and gunfights. And that's all about affronts to male honor and the importance that Americans in the 19th century placed on that.
Talk about the gunfighters' code. You say there may have been like 2 codes. One that was the code that you would sort of think about. There's a kind of etiquette. Honesty and courtesy, and you take care of your horse. You say it's kind of sometimes called the cowboy code.
That's the nice version of it.
That's the nice version of it, right. The other code is kind of a darker thing. It sort of gets to that idea of honor and pride and courage. It seems like this part contributes to a lot of the violence in the West. We talk about those codes.
Yeah, that's where I came down. Remember, the Southern male honor code, in addition to honesty and fair play and all that, its primary facet that matters to us is the idea that if your honor was criticized, if someone called you ugly or greedy or said your wife was ugly or something, whatever it was that you felt your honor was impugned, under the Southern code and later under the Western code, you were given the opportunity, in some cases the obligation, to respond with violence, even deadly violence. In the South, you know, primarily it was, you know, something that happened. You challenged a man to a duel and you duel him. In the Old West, you had the exact same triggers. The famous one that comes to mind immediately is after that fight in Springfield, Missouri in 1865. Someone asked Wild Bill Hickok, Bill, why'd you do it? Why'd you kill the man? Over a watch? Was it really that important? He said, Hickok said, this wasn't about a watch. This was because the man had attacked my honor. And that's the type of thing that you see again and again and again in the Old West. You see it at the most famously in all the talk and yelling that leads up to the gunfight beside the OK Corral in Tombstone in 1881. You just see it in so many of the gunfights. You see men who felt like they've been insulted. They've been jostled. They hadn't been given their respect. And it spirals into gun violence.
A really fascinating part of the book is when you write about the development of the sidearm, the repeater, the six-shooter. Talk about how that really changed the picture here. What changed when men started carrying guns as sidearms.
It made the gunfighter era possible. You know,
Went
back when men were shooting each other in duels in 1831 with smoothbore, you know, one single shot pistols, you're not going to have many gunfights, right? There's essentially one shot and then everybody sits around for 12 minutes reloading. Mm. You needed a revolver to be able to have fast-paced, repeatable violence. The revolver was famously invented and introduced by the inventor Samuel Colt in the late 1830s. It was a resounding flop. Nobody used them. They were considered big and unwieldy. And it wasn't until a young group that no one had ever heard of outside Texas, called the Texas Rangers, got their hands on some in 1844 and used them to basically obliterate a crowd of Comanche warriors, that the Rangers were like, wow, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. And one of them headed back east to meet this Colt fella and find ways to make this gun more usable, lighter, faster, easier to reload, all of which set the scene for the years after the Civil War. You know, a lot of people look at the Civil War and say, golly, a lot of these gunfighters surely were ex-soldiers who were scarred by their war years, who probably had PTSD. I think there's probably something to that, but given that very few of these men left diaries and none of them blamed the war, that has to remain speculative. But what's not speculative is the incredible spread of sidearms in 1865 and 1866. Something on the order of 1.3 million pistols and sidearms were auctioned or given away by the federal government after the war. And you can find memoirs. I'm thinking of a wonderful one in Missouri who say, you know, suddenly now that everybody's wearing a gun on their belt, we're not having fist fights anymore. These things are much faster and much deadlier. Look, we had had what we call today open carry in the U.S. before, especially in rural areas of the South. Yet it remained so unusual that Northerners and Outlanders were always commenting on it. It really wasn't until the years immediately after the Civil War that it became kind of an accepted part of Western and rural society to wear a pistol, much as men wore eyeglasses or a tie. Mm-hmm. It just became an accepted part of American apparel. And yeah, I think it's fair to say that with everyone having ready access to handguns, they were used more often.
How much did the sense of resentment for Confederate soldiers and people in the South, how much did that contribute to the gunfighter era? This, I think this gets us to one of the great characters, and I don't mean great by his morals, but Wes Hardin, John Wesley Hardin. As you describe him, probably or certainly one of the most prolific killers in Old West history. He was a piece of work. And one of the things you write about is he said that, and you can talk about his story here in a second, but when he's really young, like 15 years old, he, you say, found himself a deeply resentful fugitive, and not from justice, but from the injustice and misrule of the people who had subjugated the South. So talk about that context and talk about Hardin.
When you look at the factors that created these gunfighters and these gunfights, the male honor system has to be, it's the most important. But you're not explaining it fully if you don't look at other factors, including, you know, the incredible resentment that Southerners had over the fact that the North won the war and in Texas, you know, swept in to a state that did not feel that it had lost any battles on its own soil. And suddenly Texans, who are legendarily proud, hence the term that I've always loved, Texas exceptionalism, and suddenly they found themselves occupied by blue-coated soldiers, many of them men of color, and Texans did not have much use for these people. What erupted in Texas in the 5 years after the Civil War was something like an open rebellion. Its primary facet, a series of feuds that rank among the deadliest feuds in American history, far deadlier than Hatfield and McCoy, mostly taking place across North Texas and East Texas, which, as it happened, was the area of Texas where John Wesley Hardin grew up. He was 15 in 1868 when he killed his first man, a black man he got into an argument with, at which point he was obliged to kind of become a fugitive. Not that he was ever really in any danger, given the patchy state of law enforcement in Texas in those early years, but he became the first archetype of the wandering gunfighter. Mm-hmm. John Wesley Hardin was not an outlaw. He was not a lawman. He was a gambler. He was sometimes a cattleman. He just wandered the state, rootless, getting into countless arguments and killing people. By the time he was 21, the best guess is he had killed between 26 and 42 people. Most of them killed before he was 18. The most famous, I started to say you could write a book about Hardin. Well, many people have. He is a fascinating character, and probably the high point of his career comes when he came face to face with that thing that you just mentioned, the idea of, you know, Yankee lawmen or Yankee occupiers. Yeah. When he became a cattleman, and I want to say he was 18, he took a ride up the Chisholm Trail with a load of cattle with his cousins, as many Texas cowboys were prone to do. He reached Abilene, Kansas, which was the first great Kansas cow town, and the first place where these hyper-violent Texas cowboys mm-hmm. came face-to-face with Northern lawmen. And in that case, this was kind of the birth of the gunfighter era, because the lawman who ran Abilene in that day happened to be Wild Bill Hickok, the only gunfighter most Americans ever heard. Mm. Hardin was in Hickok's Abilene for 3.5 months. And by my count, he killed 8 men, including most famously a man that he killed by shooting through a hotel room wall at 4 a.m. And people always poo-pooed the legend that he killed the man who happened to be another Texas cattleman for snoring. But frankly, why else would you shoot through a hotel room wall at 4 a.m? I kind of want to believe the snoring thing. But, you know, so Hardin was kind of the apotheosis of this type of Texan that we're talking about. He came face to face famously with Hickok once. Hickok knew he was in town, gave him a wide berth, allowed him to wear his guns openly against local law, as sheriffs tended to do in those days, but finally had to confront him when Hardin got into an argument in a bowling alley in June of 1871, right there in Abilene. He confronted him and said, he called him Little Arkansas, because that was the site of one of his gunfights in the area, was on the Little Arkansas River. And he said, "I need your guns." And Hardin, by his telling, the only one that survives, handed them forward, both guns, butt forward. But then once Hickok reached for them, Hardin twirled them in a maneuver called the road agent's spin,
yeah,
so that the barrels were suddenly facing Hickok, at which point you think that the end of the story is, you know, John Wesley Hardin kills Hickok, but he didn't. Hickok was an older man, smoother, had been here before, and basically said, "Little Arkansas, what are you doing? Let's have a drink. We don't need to do this." So the Hardin-Hickok confrontation was kind of the most famous non-gunfight in Old West history, but people still comb through it and tell that story today.
That road agent spin maneuver, that comes up in another part of the book, as I recall.
There was another time he did it, and we know he did it because he killed a Texas right. state policeman
right.
named Green Paramore. Later that same year, once he returned to Texas, two Texas state policemen tried to arrest him for one of his myriad killings in a general store in rural Texas. And Hardin did the exact same maneuver, but this time he used it to shoot and kill Green Paramore. And the poor other officer, who had no idea what was going on until he heard a gunshot, was sitting on a mule outside. Hardin comes out, shoots the guy through the cheek. The guy's mule bolts. And Hardin, you know, chases him until the poor guy manages to jump into a lake and survive. But that's the type of kind of daily adventure or action or murder that dominates Hardin's story. There's no one quite like John Wesley Hardin in the Old West.
Brian Burrow, his book is The Gunfighters, How Texas Made the West Wild. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Thank you. Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Brian Burrow is with us, telling the true story behind the gunfighters of the American West. And they're thought of as myths and legends: Wyatt Earp, Billy the Kid, the duels, the train robberies. But Burrow says this wasn't a myth. All of that blood and violence, he says, was real. His book is called The Gunfighters: How Texas Made the West Wild. Let's talk about Wyatt Earp. Where does he fit in all of this? He's the one who seems to live up to the legend in a real way for you.
Well, Earp is probably my favorite because he's the towering one, to my mind. In writing about gunfighters, you were writing about, let's face it, an awful lot of men who you probably would not hire to babysit your 13-year-old. Right. You know, these were some tough guys.
Yeah.
And as our telling of John Wesley Hardin's story suggests, they're not always the nicest, most civil guys. When you glance at Earp, first thought is he would be an easy legend to take down. This is a guy, after all, we know, who started out as a pimp.
Yeah.
He ran brothels. We now know, thanks to 21st century research, that for the extent of the time that he was a lawman in the frontier, he also was an escaped federal prisoner. A year before he became a lawman in Kansas, he had been arrested for stealing horses and had actually escaped from a jail, a federal jail in Arkansas, to go out onto the frontier. Mm-hmm. So you would think that he would be, oh, that Burrow guy, he's going to take Wyatt Earp down. And, you know, I just can't do it, because if you read everything about Earp, you can see that, you know, at a time where an awful lot of lawmen on the old West frontier were corrupt or drunk or both, he was the real deal. You can see in any number of incidents I could cite where he was a hardworking lawman who surrounded himself with hardworking deputies who actually took seriously the idea of safety and security in the towns where they worked. Earp was part of a kind of new first wave, if you will, of lawmen, including the Texas Rangers, reintroduced to Texas in the mid-70s. And that was almost exactly the time where Earp was achieving renown in the Kansas cow towns. But what really made him fascinating to me is he was imperfect, because, you know, when pressed to the ultimate in Tombstone, he went outside the law when his two brothers were shot, one of them killed, Morgan. Wyatt famously went on the Vendetta ride and killed several members of the gang who he believed, without a trial, had killed his brother. So he's not a perfect specimen by any means of Western lawman, but he's about as good as we had. Huh. And to my mind, his failing was legal rather than moral. And it just humanizes him. And I think in some ways contributes to an image of him as really, at least among the gunfighters, the one who has a genuine moral authority, one that's not unchallengeable, but that shines through the literature. Wyatt Earp really, I think, you know, stands alone among the gunfighters in that regard.
Another one that I thought, and he was, of course, a friend of Wyatt Earp, was Doc Holliday. And talk about an interesting sort of different character. I mean, he was a dentist. He saved Wyatt Earp's life. They became friends. You've said he was a very kind of unlikely gunfighter.
Doc Holliday has to go down as the least likely of the major gunfighters. Huh. He was a small man. He was, you know, he had tuberculosis. Pat Masterson famously wrote in 1907 that a teenager, a kid, could have beaten up a Holliday. And, you know, one suspects that as a result of his physical weakness, he might have been more prone to turn to violence than others. He not only carried, you know, a Colt and a Derringer, but a large knife that he called the Hell Bitch. He used them all a number of times. But what was interesting about Holliday is he had this penchant for empathy and for friendship and almost a protective note that he struck around Wyatt. There was the famous moment in Dodge where they were only acquaintances, and during a bar fight, Wyatt in later years told of a moment that a Texan drew down on him and was about to shoot him in the back, when Holliday either shot the man, shot in the air, or yelled at the guy, "Hey, Wyatt." And, but whatever he did, he created conditions that Wyatt believed for the rest of his life had saved his life. And his loyalty
to Wyatt is really, I think, well captured in the movie Tombstone. You get a sense in the Dennis Quaid performance and also in the Val Kilmer performance in the Wyatt Earp movie, a very clear sense of his incredible and intense, almost homoerotic loyalty to Earp. Remember that as the Earp brothers were, you know, poised to walk down to famously engage the bad guys, the members of the cowboy gang, in that vacant lot beside the OK Corral. Yeah. You know, Doc wanders up and says, what's going on? He wasn't up to speed. He'd been taking a nap, and they told him what was about to happen. And Wyatt famously said to him, this isn't your fight. You don't need to be doing this. It's going to be a tough one. And Doc famously smiled and said, tough ones are the ones I like most, and went down and stood beside them and fought it out with the cowboy gang. It is a unique friendship in the annals of Western gunfighters.
While we're on the subject, let's talk a little bit about the movies. You once asked if anyone can think of a good classic Western. What are the ones that you think get there, the ones that work, that get it right, whether they're exactly right? What are the ones that you can think of that you think that work?
I said that in an interview early in the publicity, and I almost misspoke because I shouldn't have said a good classic Western because there are any number of them, from The Gunfighter to Shane to High Noon. Yeah. What I meant was an historically accurate Western, and that's why I enjoy them. It's so easy for us to sit here and make fun of old Westerns, and I find that people often do that without acknowledging that they've changed significantly over the years. Yes, you can look back at some of the hoary tropes popularized in the 30s, 40s, and 50s and say that that's the way all movies are. But the fact is, since the 60s, and especially the early 1970s, after the Butch and Sundance movie from 69, you know, American Westerns, those that want to claim authenticity, have come pretty darn close in my estimation. You can point to a string of movies beginning with the 69 Butch and Sundance on through the Jesse James story told in Walter Hill's The Long Riders in, I believe, 1980, but famously up through the 92 Wyatt Earp and the 1993 Tombstone. You'd have to say that group of movies alone, and there's another dozen that I could probably tick off if I could only remember them here, were pretty darn close to accurate. I mean, look, in Tombstone, I was rewatching it the other night for at least the third time this year, but you know, I often want to be taken back to that spot. And I just remembered, oh my goodness, it opens with this entirely fictional massacre of an entire Latino village, which, while of course it never happened, stood in for, you know, a string of atrocities that this cowboy gang did enact in and around Tombstone. So even when you say these movies are closer to accurate and authentic, you have to always keep in mind there is always going to be Hollywood's heavy hand.
You know, I think about something I detected in your book is just the idea of trying to make the violence real. It wasn't romanticized. It was a reality in the American West. And a movie that conveyed that, at least to me, was Unforgiven. And I wonder what you think about that film.
You are killing me. I once belonged 25 years ago to a gentleman's discussion group. And for their kind of annual banquet at one point, I was tasked with giving my take on the top 10 American movies of all time. And many of them were, you know, Citizen Kane, the Casablanca, the classics.
Yeah.
And at number 8, my controversial one was Unforgiven, because I consider Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven, I can't say it's the greatest Hollywood Western because I haven't seen them all, especially a lot of the early ones. What I say is it's my favorite because it's the ultimate Hollywood anti-Western. It's the ultimate Western that shows not only the reality of Western violence. Remembering the movie now, and I haven't seen it in a year or two, I just don't remember a lot of scenes that strike you as inauthentic. I mean, the kid chickening out, you know, Morgan Freeman not being able to go through it. And then, you know, the price that they pay individually without a single note of preachiness. And that's hard to make essentially an anti-violence movie that is deeply violent and yet shows you the costs and the price. And one could argue, I think, with validity, that it comes close, well, let's put it this way, it comes close to striking the tone I imagine and that I write about here in Trying to Gather the Facts. I mean, stellar. Stellar choice by you. I could, in that you agree with me.
Yeah. Great mind. One of the things that you write in the book, I wanted to ask you about, you said reading the stories of some of these gunfighters, you're struck by what you say is the arbitrary nature of fame. And I wanted to ask you about that. Cause this is going to get us to Billy the Kid, who I think it's an interesting character because he's a snitch and a kind of common cattle rustler. How does he become a legend?
This was one of the stories I grappled with most. I do in a book that's what, 20 chapters, three of them are about Billy the Kid.
Right.
He looms so large. People don't even know what Billy the Kid is. They always say he's an outlaw. Well, an outlaw to me suggests like bank robbery or something serious. Yeah. About the most you can say about Billy the Kid as an outlaw is he was a cattle thief. He was a cattle thief, he was a murderer, and when he got caught, he was a snitch. Billy the Kid had two careers. One was as a feudist, a fighter in the Lincoln County War, which his side lost. And then secondarily, he went out and had a career as a cattle thief. And it was then that he became famous. He got the nickname very late in his career by a New Mexico newspaper editor who called him Billy the Kid. Mm-hmm. By my estimation, he was the second nationally famous Western outlaw slash gunfighter after Jesse James, who, as we know, was not one, but okay. Billy the Kid was.
Yeah.
He had a moment. He was not nationally famous. Like for years, people didn't. He was one of those characters that we see them all the time today. Someone who popped into the headlines for a matter of months, got killed, and then was utterly forgotten.
Yeah.
Like he dies in what? I want to say 81. In fact, the whole rediscovery of the Old West gunfighter begins in the mid-1920s with a magazine article in which the first sentence, the writer says, "Who remembers Billy the Kid?" Hmm. And that really leads more than any moment to the rediscovery of gunfighters. But it shows you how important Hollywood is in fictionalized versions of these people are in creating their fame. The fictional Billy the Kid that arose in silent movies and then in, you know, a string of, I mean, literally dozens of movies into the 50s and 60s, it did more for Billy the Kid's fame than reality ever did. The Billy the Kid of history is fascinating to me because even having written this book and researched him exhaustively, if you told me to write a book on Billy the Kid, I could give you 16 versions of Billy the Kid. I could give you Billy the Kid, the evil murderer, which was the version that prevailed mostly during his life. But then a second version, at least, of Billy that would accrue all his positive characteristics that spoke to writers later, many years after his death. His loyalty, his daring, the fact that he, even during his lifetime, there was this sense, not really backed by the facts, that because he was friendly with so many Latinos in New Mexico, that he was a social bandit, somehow fighting for the Latino cause, which of course he wasn't.
Right.
So he's fascinating to me. He can be viewed so many different ways.
Brian Burrow, his book is The Gunfighters, How Texas Made the West Wild. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Brian Burrow. We're talking about his book, The Gunfighters. I have to ask you, what the hell is the deal behind the idea of making a person dance at gunpoint? This is something you said you kind of wanted to look into, couldn't really figure it out. But say something about that phenomenon. I think this is so interesting.
Well, there are a series of things that you realize upon, you know, diving into the minutiae of the Old West and especially the Old West gunfighters. And that is, there are a series of minor behaviors that are so out there and over the top that you think they were the creation of Hollywood films. And then you realize, wait, people were actually doing this stuff in reality.
Yeah.
One might be, I'm thinking, one of Butch Cassidy's robberies, circa 1899. His partner, Elsie Lay, L-A-Y, challenges a young man who was about to interfere with their robbery of a messenger. And he basically says something to the effect of, "Halt, or I'll fill your belly full of hot lead." And you're like, really? They talked like that? At which point you kind of have to acknowledge, you know, this was 1890. Yeah. Dime novels had been out there for 30 years. Maybe the guy was just saying the things that he'd read about in books. But the funniest one, or the saddest one, depending on your take, is this idea that there really were mean-tempered gunmen in the Old West who pointed guns at people and said, "Now dance." Now, I don't have a specific example in which the bad guy shot at the good guy's feet while he danced.
Yeah, that's a movie
thing. Well, it may be. Yes. I can't say it didn't happen.
Right, right.
One
of course.
Time where it did happen was when a guy with Billy the Kid, not Billy the Kid's friend or anything, but a nasty-tempered Texan named Billy Campbell in the streets of Lincoln, New Mexico, was drunk and accosted a local lawyer, put a gun to his chest and said, "Now you dance," for no reason whatsoever. Right. And the gun went off and killed the poor guy. And he falls to the ground, his clothing aflame. Right. And the men then laugh and go to a restaurant and eat oysters. I mean, I thought that this was the stuff of movies. Yeah. I mean, where did this idea even come from? I mean, I think I say in one of the footnotes, there's an academic paper here for someone.
Right. Well, you mentioned Butch Cassidy, and let's get there finally, because, you know, it gets us to Utah, sort of.
It gets you to Utah. This is Utah's really high moment
in
Old West history, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, you write about how the Mountain West became what you call sort of the final province of the cattle kingdom. And you write about how these gangs of thieves and rustlers, you know, formed during this time. And there's this section that's come to be known as the Outlaw Trail. I think some people around here know a little bit about it, but tell us a little bit about the Outlaw Trail.
Well, the Outlaw Trail was used by any number of people who would just as soon not, you know, have a sit down with a sheriff. Yeah. There were three hideouts. The northernmost, Jackson Hole, was in Wyoming. The middle one was Brown's Hole, mm-hmm. which I believe is on the Utah-Wyoming border, and then famously Robber's Roost, which is way off in kind of the quasi-desert in southeast Utah, up on a plateau. All these places were hard to get into. You know, they had conventional settlers, at least in Brown's Hole, and they were easily defensible at a time where, you know, an awful lot of lawmen as late as the 1880s and 1890s were not going to trek off over 60 miles of desert with no water to go to a desert plateau that was manned by outlaws. That was just not a thing that lawmen did before the modern era. And the outlaw who popularized this network was Butch Cassidy. He used all three, especially Robber's Roost. Although, you know, I've always kind of wondered how important they really were, because when Butch actually disappeared for a period of 2 years after his first two robberies, he didn't go to one of these places. He and his buddy Elsie Lay went off to a conventional ranch and just became cowboys under assumed names in New Mexico.
I wondered about that, actually. How many of these gunfighters had that as their full-time job? Or how many were doing a little bit of robbing, a little bit of this and that, but also were being cowboys and ranch hands?
Hard to say. Actually, not a concept I spent a lot of time on. As the thing that made Butch different is his career was at the tail end of the frontier. We're talking the last two or three years of the 1890s, before the end of the century. And being an outlaw then was sharply different than it was during Jesse James' period. One of the through lines of the book is the gradual professionalization of law enforcement in the Old West. Right. So you see early gunfighters and outlaws like Wes Hardin and Jesse James kind of being pursued with half measures by bumbling or drunken law enforcement types. And by the 1890s, you've got not only more professional and federal law enforcement, but you've got the rise of the Pinkerton private agency, such that, you know, by 1900, when Butch began to think, it's just the frontier is closing in around me, you know, the Pinkertons could be anywhere. And so in my memory of the major outlaws, Butch was the only one that really, for a prolonged period of time, 2 years, went off and masqueraded as a private citizen.
Did you like Butch as a character?
Oh, I loved him because in real time, during his criminal career, although there were not a ton of available facts about him, what little was known contributed to a dash of public popularity. Mm-hmm. In his first known bank robbery in Montpelier, Idaho, I want to say in 96, 98, right in there someplace, his buddy LZ Lay, who, as you're deducing from my third reference to him, was far more prominent as one of his partners than the Sundance Kid.
Right,
LZ went to hit one of the bank tellers, and Butch snapped from the door, "You leave that man alone." And of course, that popped up in every news account of it. So there was some sense that this new guy, reportedly named, you know, Leroy Parker slash Butch Cassidy, was a little bit different than other kind of hard bitten types. And it set a note of, I don't know, almost wonder and amazement at the news stories of Butch's career. I think it improved also by the sense that Butch was not a man killer. He was obviously not a gunfighter, but gunfighter adjacent, as I've said, because like Jesse James, by and large, he was not out to shoot people. Mm. He just shot back when he was shot at. And there's no record unlike Jesse James, there's no record of Butch ever killing anyone in the few times he did use his gun. And, you know, I think what makes Butch just the perfect way to end the story is he was the single smart outlaw out of all of them who realized we can't keep doing this. This isn't the old West anymore. Mm-hmm. It's 1901. We've got to find another job. And his solution, and it's just the perfect way to end the story, was to walk into a freighter with his buddy Sundance and a woman friend there in Brooklyn and disappear to South America, where he and Sundance lived as cattlemen and occasionally at the end outlaws until about 1908 when they finally were killed.
Yeah. So in that real sense, when Butch and Sundance did leave for Buenos Aires, it was the end of the gunfighter era. But you also say, in fact, it wasn't over in the sense that it's never really been over, I guess because it endures culturally. Is that what you mean?
I actually meant that in the broadest possible sense.
Huh.
You know, in 1901, when they disappear, the frontier was closing and violence in the West was moving from headlines into history. I meant that it was never over in that people never stopped shooting people in the West and elsewhere.
Right.
Well, what was over was really the rampant romanticization of them. Mm. I think I'm missing a syllable there, but I think you know what I mean.
Yeah.
When, you know, the book The Virginian comes out, Owen Wister in 1901, and then Remington's art and sculpture, and then silent movie Westerns really take off. There's a sense that gunfighter violence lives on, you know, in the private world, yes, but mostly now in literature and film. And so it's never really ended. It's just the reality, the history of it was clearly fading. By 1901, you had streetcars mm-hmm. clanging down the streets of Denver and Fort Worth, and, you know, automobiles weren't far behind.
So does this come and go, this interest in, this affection for, you know, the legend of gunfighters? One of the things you mentioned in the book is you said it seems to be passing. I mean, you have like the Yellowstone series and some that seem kind of popular, but where is it today, do you think? Where is it headed?
I think that the gunfighter remains one of the most important architects of American myth, literature, and film. But I don't sense that as popular as Taylor Sheridan and his shows are, I think we have to acknowledge that compared to the way gunfighter Westerns dominated mainstream television during the 1950s and Western movies, you know, dominated a large swath of Hollywood output from the 20s into the 70s, mm. that the Western is in decline. And that's not to say it's a terminal decline, but I mean, when was the last time a really notable Western came out on film? You know, there are still Billy the Kid miniseries that come out every 5 years. And if you look deep into the Netflix archives, I'm sure you can find some Wild Bill Hickok movie from the last 10 or 15 years. But other than the Sheridan stuff, which is fictionalized, you don't get a sense that these entertainments are any longer central to the American zeitgeist they once were. As I say in the book, and I don't believe this is an observation that's original to me, so many the death knell for this, to my mind, was the movie Star Wars, because so many of the entertainments that we once set in the old West are now set in outer space.
Does that make you sad?
Yes and no. Because I write and read almost exclusively history, I'm not uniquely but especially sensitive to the ebbs and flow of history, how things move into the American popular imagination, how they move away, sometimes for 50 years. And then 50 years later, someone writes a sentence like, "Who remembers Billy the Kid?" And it all comes flooding back.
Brian Burrow, thank you very much.
Thanks, Doug.
Brian Burrow, his latest book is called The Gunfighters, How Texas Made the West Wild. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on YouTube at KUER 90.1, on Instagram at Radio West, or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.